rock and roll experience. A rock and roll experience. A rock and roll experience. A rock and roll experience.
Programming on listener-supported community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM for Saturday, the 27th of September, 1997. Radio Bandung is broadcast Saturday afternoons from 2 to 3. Our mission is to critique colonialism in all of its forms and to track the psychogeography of capital. Radio Bandung exposes not only political fascism, but personal fascism as well. That is the desire to be led. My name is Chong Yun Lim. Times read, nonprofits Wall Street home filling up. It began. The Association Center opened 5 years ago at 120 Wall Street to help keep national and international nonprofit organizations from leaving New York City because of high rents is about to become 100% occupied. Roger A. Silverstein, Vice President of Silverstein Properties, runs the Association Center building, which was created in cooperation with the city's Economic Development Corporation and occupies 20 floors of the 34-storied structure, which was built in 1929. Mervyn Rothstein, the writer of the article, continues, because of incentives from the city's Industrial Development Agency, nonprofit organizations that rent in the building are exempt from city real estate taxes, which are usually passed on by landlords to tenants as part of the rent. One of the tenants of 120 Wall Street is WBAI Pacifica Radio. According to sources, a lease for spaces for offices was signed this past week. And this weekend, as we speak, the Pacifica Foundation convenes its governing board meeting in Washington's DuPont Plaza Hotel, where on the agenda are plans to implement illegal bylaw changes, which will fundamentally change the politics of community radio and WBAI. Pacifica listeners in California have retained legal counsel in order to block these illegal bylaw changes by Pacifica's board of directors and to open Pacifica policy and financial documents to the public. What is the connection, if any, between the secrecy with which the move to 120 Wall Street is couched and the corporatized takeover of Pacifica Radio? Radio Bandung risks airing dirty laundry if it means exposing dirty money.
I think that there's a tremendous emphasis placed on trying to show that great things are happening in the Wall Street area. The developers down there are trying to expand their market. They're trying to create excitement. They're trying to make more money. And one way you make more money is by saying, you better buy now because everybody's coming down here. This is the hot place. And they were filling up fast. Everybody's looked at Wall Street as this empty canyon, but no, that's wrong. Everybody's coming. You know, even the lefties, even WBAI is coming. We're rounding them all up.
And for the lefties and for these progressive institutions, what do you think they need to be wary of in making this move?
Well, I think that they would be concerned that they not follow somebody else's agenda. And that they want to do more than just swell the rent rolls of developers who've managed to extract staggering tax breaks from the city that are being given out, you know, on a nine-figure basis at a time that we've instituted the work experience program and thrown 200,000 people off the welfare rolls in 20 months.
But it sounds like that would not be possible, that even buying into this argument that the rent is cheaper there, which would be to the benefit of nonprofits, that in fact one is maybe even tacitly supporting the kind of transfer of capital that you've just described. Or how can one keep from participating even tacitly in that program?
Don't go.
As simple as that.
Yeah.
What about what says here, almost $6 per square foot in difference in rent fees? That adds up, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, principals always demand trade-offs, and that's why principal people are admired, because they do things against the flow, that they don't always do the cheapest thing. And sometimes they put principle before money.
Hmm. So is it your opinion that it's not a good idea for BAI to be moving down to Wall Street?
Well, I am just very occasionally a guest, as I am on your show.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's the decision that really has to be made by the WBAI people who are most affected by it. But I hope they would take principles into account when they make their decision.
Let's talk about why we're facing the kind of real estate glut that we are in New York at the moment. Why was there so much development 15 years earlier?
Yeah, well, I would say that there is an enormous amount of space that is being rented now, and the vacancy rates have come down. I don't want to give WBAI listeners the notion that we're still in 1991 with 60 million square feet of empty space. They have dented that enormous amount, but it's important to understand how the glut got to be so big in New York City. Why was there so much empty space? Why did we have over 25% vacancy rates downtown? And the reason is not simply the workings of the free market, which are often quite irrational in itself. The irrationalities of the boom and bust real estate market were tremendously exacerbated by the city's policy, particularly by something called the Midtown Plan, which was initiated by nonprofits, which was initiated by foundations, particularly the Rockefeller Foundation. Their concern at the time, particularly the concern of the Rockefeller family in the late 1970s when they began to hatch this plan, was that although real estate was beginning to pick up from the slump of the mid-70s, there wasn't any action on the West Side. All the building that was being done was being done on the East Side. So they conceived a plan to shift all the development from the East Side to the West Side. They wanted all the development to be on the West Side, where they had their property and where they had empty lots where they wanted to develop. This plan called for massive tax subsidies. You didn't have to pay taxes for 23 years. You could build buildings, you know, practically as tall as you wanted. And they managed to get this plan accepted by the city. And as a result, they were really effective. Whereas before the plan started, the year before the plan started, all the buildings in the city were being built on the east side by 1988, which was when they phased out the subsidies. All the buildings in the city were built on the west side. They were all built where you see all these new buildings created. Now, what happened was that they created many more buildings than the city needed. They created about 54 million square feet of empty space. And the downtown tenants went uptown into these new, spiffy, high-tech, friendly buildings from the older buildings that were that they occupied downtown, and left downtown completely empty. One of the worst real estate disasters in modern history. So how do you take care of that? Same way you took care of the Rockefellers. You create a gigantic subsidy program that converts the empty office space into something else. So they got something called the Downtown Lower Manhattan Plan that gives developers $250 million worth of subsidies to convert from office to residential and to other uses. That plan was passed a couple of years ago, and we're seeing this massive rate of conversion going on down there in an effort to hype downtown as a new kind of community that's not just dependent on banks and insurance companies and the old kind of tenants that they have. And the WBAI people are part of this new community that is being subsidized to the tune of $250 million.
What kinds of buildings were built on the west side, or how was that decision made?
The Midtown Plan, which was passed in 1981, dictated that you could build these big, enormous, modern buildings. Worldwide Plaza, for example, they did a movie on it, and a book came out about it. It was one of the buildings that was built under this plan. But a lot of the hotels that you see on the west side were originally planned as office buildings to take advantage of the subsidies, but when the glut came, they decided to convert from office to hotel. So the type of building was strictly a function of the zoning regulations that was created by the plan. You could build a lot thicker, you could build a lot higher, and so they all did. But it was sort of like the crowd that goes early to beat its own rush. They created this enormous glut.
And it seems that the role of nonprofits and foundations were integral to the development of this real estate glut that we're seeing. Will you talk about what it means to be nonprofit? I know technically one applies for that status so that you're tax exempt, but it seems to me increasingly that nonprofits are acting in almost commercial-like capacities.
Well, I think that they are acting in capacities that used to be acted by city government. We see in, you know, case after case dimensions of public policy are converted so that you have the nonprofits doing them. Where you used to have you know, city people who were picking up kids, that's all been turned over to the nonprofits. The idea is to eliminate unionized workers and civil service and substitute much lower paid people who are supervised by the nonprofits. The advantage of this, of course, is that the big real estate people who pay the lion's share of real estate taxes in the city, which are in turn the most important component of taxes in the city, pay less money, and you get rid of unions. They like that. That's the role that nonprofits play in substituting for public sector workers.
And that would seem to be perhaps one way in which city or government agencies are privatized?
That's the main way. What you do, even in those cases where you don't privatize, you offer the workers a chance to bid against the nonprofits or the profits, as far as that's concerned, for their jobs, so that you knock down the scale of their work by creating more competition. And it's all part of the effort to lower taxes and destroy labor standards in the city.
How conscious or aware are nonprofits of this role that they've taken on themselves?
Well, I think it depends upon the nonprofit. I don't think that Brooklyn, the Central Brooklyn Church that is providing daycare services, is setting this agenda and is consciously thinking of how do we destroy unions. But I think at the very top of the foundation food chain, when we're talking about the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation and the Kaplan Foundation, that they're very conscious of these things, that their ties with banking and finance are very explicit, and that this is the reason why they're driving this agenda.
You could call this a kind of structural adjustment plan in New York.
Well, I think you can call it that, or you can call it union busting, or you can call it kicking poor people. It all amounts to the same agenda, and it helps to explain why the top financial institutions in New York that are involved in real estate are making more money than they've ever made. Today's New York Times has a piece about Goldman Sachs, which is one of the big real estate players in the city, as well as being an investment banking house. They operate something called the Whitehall Fund, and they're very active in the institutionalization of the real estate market, taking over from families and turning them into special kinds of corporations. And in the most recent quarter that they have results for, Goldman Sachs made just about $1 billion. All right, you say, well, a lot of corporations make $1 billion. But this is just in one quarter. So figure, $4 billion a year. And then this is a private firm that doesn't have any stockholders. What they have is 190 partners. And so what you have is 190 guys, and they're all guys. There's no blacks, no women, that are sharing $4 billion. And that's 1 year's work. And it's strictly on the basis of this rising market in securities and the rising market in real estate.
What's the link between the two?
They're into both things. They are buying and selling real estate. They're creating the so-called real estate investment trusts, which are accumulating properties all over the country, especially, chiefly commercial properties. And the stocks of these companies are rising, and so it pays to form more and more. And Goldman Sachs forms the real estate investment trust, and it's involved in the buying and selling of real estate here in the city in a very major way.
What do you know about the Association Center, which is running 120 Wall Street for nonprofits? Silverstein Properties, which runs the Association Center.
Yeah, well, Silverstein is an extremely well-connected real estate developer who got caught up in the real estate mania in the 1980s and went bankrupt. He developed downtown properties in particular. I can't remember which number World Trade Center. There were like two gigantic buildings that he developed and had government backing for, but he wasn't able to fill the buildings, and he went bankrupt. There's also been persistent rumors about his involvement with organized crime. I can't really determine how valid the stories are, but I think that it's important to realize, generally speaking, that the key unions in this city, like the Carpenters Union, like the Plumbers Union, like the Mason Tenders and Laborers Union, have had consistent mafia control, and that it's very difficult to do business in the city without dealing with organized crime. And the developers who prosper are generally ones that work with organized crime and benefit from the kind of muscle that organized crime can deliver, especially in the way of supplying you with non-union workers, non-union contractors, along the lines of what Trump was able to accomplish with Trump Tower. It's a famous story about the Polish immigrants that he had taking out the asbestos that were working for below minimum wage.
How does a man who goes bankrupt return to the position that he is in? Silverstein running what is now an increasingly growing market of nonprofit rentals in Wall Street.
I think that he's just doing what a lot of them did. A lot of them went from development into management. They knew something about real estate, and if you manage buildings, you get a cash cow. And maybe he's using management to get him back into development. Trammell Crowe is an example of a guy who is a lot bigger than Silverstein who's doing that. There are many cases of that.
What about an organization or the Newmarket Company Real Estate and Time Equities, brokers who specialize in placing nonprofits? What kind of groups are they?
To the best of my knowledge, these are just groups that play the game. They're brokers. They make a lot of money finding you and putting you over there.
Whom are they making the money?
From the landlords that want to put tenants in the building. But also from the tenants who want to find a place.
Uh-huh.
Some of them are tenant people and some of them are landlord people.
Right. One broker from Newmarket Company said, what we need is an across-the-board solution, such as some kind of tax abatement to any landlord who rents to nonprofits. Do you think that's a solution to the problem that we have?
Well, I think that it's the kind of solution that politicians love because they're always getting contributions from landlords, and they would like an excuse to do favors for landlords. And if they can do a favor and at the same time being be seen as giving to charity, it pleases them a great deal.
Do you think the moves now to attract nonprofits to Wall Street, it would seem to go a long way in painting a different picture of Wall Street, or at least to emphasize and de-emphasize the exploitative aspect of finance capital by giving them a human face.
Well, I don't think they're particularly interested in having a human face. I think that they've been very successful with the inhuman face that they've had. And, they're market guys, whatever works. And I don't think that this is a step towards humanization. I think they're doing quite well, thank you.
Even the cynical humanism that someone like maybe Mother Teresa represents.
No, I think that they're not interested in that. I think this has to be understood in a much more narrow sense of people who have empty space and need to fill it. That's all. And that insofar as you get the nonprofits, it shows that this is a desirable location for lots of prestigious, well-thought-of businesses.
How has the perceptions of Wall Street changed in the last 20 years? Or has it at all? And what does it represent in most people's mind who know very little about what goes on there?
Well, I think that because the market has quadrupled in value over the last 8 or 9 years, it's created literally trillions of dollars of new wealth for a very small sector of the population who were, thrilled. You just put your money there and the next thing you know, you're rich. So I think that among a certain component of the population that people are just excited about this magical money machine. The people at Goldman Sachs, who are going to get to divide up $4 billion, those 190 guys, you know, their allegiance to Wall Street and its principles, I'm sure, is less mitigated than ever. I think that, as you say, I think most people don't realize that Wall Street is playing increasingly a zero-sum game, and that Wall Street is able to put up these results to a large extent because of corporate downsizing programs and because of the deindustrialization of America. For example, the Wall Street Journal ran yesterday a story about Sara Lee. Sara Lee is a large manufacturing, they do actually manufacture a lot of things besides cakes. They do pantyhose-like legs, into a lot of manufacturing. They decided recently to go the way of Nike and shift all their production to countries where you know, $1 an hour is a super wage. And their stock skyrocketed as a result of that decision. So I think that the strategies that are pursued by the passive investor are ones that result in lower wages, capital export, and lower labor standards for Americans, for American working people.
Mm-hmm. What about the mythology of Wall Street that seems to be at least developed with tours stopping by Wall Street, and also the proximity to something like South Street Seaport? That was actually mentioned as a good point for moving down there at this general staff meeting at BAI, that it's only two blocks away and we have access to all these wonderful restaurants.
And, you know, you get to drink with all these Wall Street brokers who come over there and are celebrating their big trades. It's another advantage.
What about just the symbolics of being in Wall Street in that area as a nonprofit organization? Would that contradict maybe some of the missions of these groups?
Well, I think you could look at it that way, or you could look at yourself as people who are operating, as they say, in the belly of the beast. And I think it's you know, it's up to you how you decide to handle the move. Either as you know, people who are carrying out Wall Street's agenda, or because you're not involved in the decision, you're going to make the best of it and try to find out about, you know, better about how these mechanics are affecting broad masses of American people. If the market goes down, you know, I think that the focus of Radio Bandung could be very valuable, because it looks as if a lot of the reason why there may be a major downturn has to do with American investment in particularly Southeast Asian countries, and forcing big capital investment of this footloose type onto those countries, and then withdrawing it the first sign of weakness.
Mm-hmm.
Forcing them into austerity, which is bound to have not only a very bad effect on them, but increases vastly the amount of export pressure in world markets, and forces prices down, layoffs, and so forth.
I guess why I'm so skeptical about making anything good out of this move is that at least on 35th Street, when one leaves the building, you come into contact with a lot of working class people, and you, in a sense, get to see maybe not the mechanics of globalization in their lives, but at least you see the people who might be affected by them. Whereas if you go down to Wall Street, everything has been sanitized, and it seems to me a politics that focuses so much on the experience of ordinary people becomes that much more difficult. Mm-hmm. In a place like Wall Street.
Yeah, well, I visited a couple years ago the headquarters of Ms. Magazine, which is on Wall Street.
I think it's in the same building.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yes.
It did seem kind of an incongruous place to be putting out a feminist magazine. But maybe I don't understand certain types of feminism well. Yeah, it was pretty hard to distinguish between Ms. Magazine and a Wall Street law office. you know, inside, you know, there's this dark paneling, and I don't know. I think there was something about the atmosphere that made it hard to take seriously as a counterforce to the American celebration.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit more about those intangible factors like atmosphere and interior design and maybe even the way security is set up.
Mm-hmm.
I get the sense that at 120 Wall Street, there'll be far greater surveillance and who's able to come up into the offices, not just of BAI, but any organization that has its offices there.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that you can't distinguish a law firm from Ms. Magazine, the offices, how does that affect the kind of politics one practices, or doesn't it?
Well, I think it has to add up. You know, if your life world is totally purged of the experiences of people that you're trying to grasp, I think that is a problem. I think maybe it can be surmounted through heroic efforts, but it's just one more thing that you have to do when you would like to be part of a different environment where you can be part of what people are experiencing rather than being excluded from it.
You've been listening to a conversation that I had with Robert Fitch about a week and a half ago. He's the author of a book called The Assassination of New York, published by Verso Press. And just very quickly, reading from the table of contents, how New York City became poor, New York City, what went wrong, downtown errantism, the Lower Manhattan Plan, and what to do. Sounds like essential reading for anyone who's concerned about what's happening with the globalization in New York and with WBAI. We're going to take your calls. I know that I sort of sprung this interview without much of an introduction, but that's how we were introduced or told about this move to 120 Wall Street. Our number is 212-27. Another surprise dropping from the BAI management after this brief message.
Let us focus on one of the most significant events in modern history. In 1955, the Bandung Conference in Indonesia was led by Ahmad Sukarno, then head of that state. It was the first conference of its kind, attended by third world leaders, predominantly Africans and Asians. It opened the door for Asians and Africans on a diplomatic level. The U.S. government was furious not to be invited, but many blacks, a prominent black from here went, like Adam Clayton Powell, Bill Worthy, and Marguerite Cartwright, who was the first black reporter assigned at the United Nations. Sukarno was probably the most admired and beloved Asian by progressive Africans and American blacks. Malcolm held him in high esteem because Sukarno would not accommodate himself or bow down to the white man. Sukarno was the one who flung out the words, "To hell with USAID." Of course, the U.S. was not going to accept such impudent behavior. U.S. had Sukarno ousted in a coup. Sukarno never regained his position nor power, but he brought about the converging of Africans and Asians on world issues.
Back to Radio Bandung. My name is Chong Yun Lim, and you're tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI in New York. You've just been listening to the voice of Yuri Kuchiyama, who gave a talk several weeks ago at the New York Marxist School documenting the history and alliance of Asians and Africans. The music you've been listening to in the background is an offering by a good friend of Radio Bandung, Victor Takeoff. When the cat's away, the mice will play. I've just been reminded of that popular, is it nursery rhyme? Because we'd like to open our telephone lines to listeners regarding some of the issues that Robert Fitch brought up, the move to 120 Wall Street and what that will mean for the politics of Pacifica Radio and WBAI. Our number is 212-279-3400. That's 279-3400. And I hope this will be as much a forum for discussing how this move will affect the kind of radio that BAI will be practicing, and also a way to share concerns with listeners. Numbers 212-279-3400. Let's go to our calls. Hi, WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi. I've tried to follow the reasoning of the interview on about the move to 120 Wall Street.
Yes.
And I'm sorry, I can't figure out what has wood paneling got to do with anything.
I'm sorry, what's the word that you use? What has
wood paneling? Oh,
I see. He's just describing the offices of Ms. Magazine, which also is located at 120 Wall Street.
Yeah.
He talks about how difficult it was on a visual level to distinguish the offices of Ms. Magazine from any other Wall Street law firm. And I asked him how that might affect the kind of work that one does in that building, or the environment, the extent to which the environment influences the work that you do within.
And you feel that the move to... I have no opinion about the move to 120 Wall Street, except that it appears that the rent will be cheaper per square foot. But would you seriously believe that inside the walls of the offices of BAI will be influenced by what goes on down the hall?
You might have misunderstood the context in which I asked that question. It's not to say that your address will completely change or directly affect your politics, but I think we would be foolish to ignore that where we're located will have some part in the kind of work that we do. Now, choices are very deliberately being made at this stage to design a radio station. There've been meetings with producers and a space tech committee with architects to organize a space in which at least the management is calling a hospitable and a usable and a productive space for radio producers. That's at least the language in which these changes are being described. I think, though, given the work that a lot of architectural and urban historians have done, we can't ignore the visual materials which will surround us and where we're going to be located. And this is just the beginnings of what I hope will be an ongoing discussion with producers, Pacifica management and listeners on what exactly this move will mean. Now, that was just thrown off as a question I think that we need to consider. We have a full board of listeners who are waiting to get on.
Okay, just to observe one last observation and a quickie, that currently the offices are located roughly across the street from Macy's and within reach of a couple of hotels. And I don't know that that's had a deleterious effect. You know? I don't get it.
Thanks, and I'll try to respond to that, and maybe other listeners will, with concerns, respond to that as well. There's no question that one can't escape global capitals and where it will operate and how it will affect people. I don't think any of us who are concerned about what this move will mean believes that there's a more innocent space or a space uncontaminated by capital. I think there are serious questions to consider, however, that will dramatically affect the way in which radio is going to be produced at BAI once it moves down there. And one of those concerns will be a possible reduction in staff. Now, that's being called an adjustment in numbers. Call it what you will. I think it's called a firing of people to finance this move. And that's, I think, something that everyone needs to consider. And also, there's a tremendous amount of debt that the station will incur in making this move possible, somewhere of up to $200,000 and $300,000. And the question is, who's going to pay for that down the line? As far as I know, this is community radio, and that means informing not just listeners, but allowing them to take part in especially important decisions such as this. Let's go to the calls. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello. I was just listening to your show, I believe, on the move to Wall Street.
Yes.
I'd like to share just an opinion with you. I think you have some valid concerns, but all things being equal, I think you should go through with it anyway.
I don't think we have any choice. The lease has been signed this past week.
Okay, but I think you might be missing an opportunity here, because the people you mix with on 34th Street, they're already on your agenda. At Wall Street, you're going to have an opportunity to kind of preach to the people who need to hear it?
Well, I think I've heard that argument, too, that we'll be going to the belly of the beast.
I think you're going to find more open-mindedness, though, than you anticipate, because...
Open-mindedness from whom?
The people who read the Wall Street Journal. It's a logical periodical.
You mean we might find allies among finance capitalists?
Yes, because logic, remember, one of the virtues of profit is that it forces you to be logical.
And I think you're not a regular listener to WBAI, because if there's anything we've learned, it's that not just finance capital, globalization, but everything that we know as a myth which helps guide everyday life is just full of contradictions. I don't know where rationality has to play except as a myth. WBAI, you're on the air.
Oh, good afternoon. Yeah, I think you have some callers here who haven't really been keeping up. I think this is really dangerous. I think what we're looking at here is the corporatization of WBAI. There is nothing to prevent WBAI from making a lot of money, from having corporate sponsors and loading the programs with corporate messages as NPR and the NPR station WNYC for one have been doing. You hear a lot from Archer Daniels Midland, and Archer Daniels Midland has been getting a free ride from the NPR stations.
Right. Caller, just two questions. One, what leads you to believe WBAI is being corporatized? And two, did you happen to catch the report to the listener yesterday at noon?
No, I did not. If you can give me a quick rundown, or give us a quick rundown, it would be great. But to answer your question, I think the move to the attempt to get the unpaid workers at WBAI off the bargaining table is a move in that direction. I think the move towards more Pacifica programming and an effort to reduce the work of local producers is another one. I think this whole thing is very dangerous. We've heard very little. You know, you call it airing dirty laundry. I call it informing the people, the listeners, as to what is going on in the station to support with their money.
Thank you for your call. We'll go to some other callers who are waiting to go on. I called it airing dirty laundry because according to Pacifica regulations, producers are barred from broadcasting anything on air which has some, which deals with the internal politics of Pacifica WBAI, and also because some people's dirty laundry is actually other people's information or dirty truth. Let's take another call. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I was a little confused. I did listen to the report from the listener. Are you soliciting input because you missed it and want to hear about it, or you just want to have an informed caller who has problems with it?
Both.
Because, okay, great. Number one, I think it's good they move it around so we can have access, because I'm usually in a car or mass transit at that morning one. Samori Marksman, he did something really that I would call indirect airing dirty laundry. He said there are those of us who really work, and then he mentioned names. He said David Rothenberg, Michio Kaku. He mentioned maybe six names. I hope BAI has the courtesy of an air check or whatever you call it when shows are taped for people in the working establishment to peruse. Do they do that?
I know individual producers keep a record of their...
It would be wonderful, because right now with all this intellectual property stuff, I'm almost afraid to mail a tape of an on-air show back to WBAI management to complain about something. I mean, I'd hate to have a lawsuit for taping their property. But anyway, Samori Marksman spent a good 12 minutes saying some of the problems have to do with defining what a unit of work is. There are these people around here that just talk and in the background are here. But then again, there's those of us, he might not have said us, he might have said there are those who really do the work. And he mentioned names. He mentioned a lot of names. He said David Rothenberg, he said Michio Kaku. I'd say he mentioned maybe eight names, as if to contrast them with other people.
There you see the beginnings of a division among staff members.
But that sounds like
the unions between paid and non-paid, and here with Samora, yet another distinction between those who pull their weight and those who don't.
I would hope you get a hold of a tape of it, because, I mean, if that's not an indirect slap to people that he didn't mention. I mean, it begs the question, if you're saying David Rothenberg, Michio Kaku, blah, blah, blah. Again, he mentioned a lot of names. I don't know what, but I have trouble with the whole issue of Valerie Van Isler not being there, and there just doesn't seem to be any feedback. But my call at the time was about producers that on-air solicit money, and he totally misconstrued it. He thought I was criticizing the fundraisers.
Right. I'm sorry, I have to cut you off. Valerie Van Isler, I think, was at the national board meeting that Pacifica's board of directors is convening as we speak in Washington's DuPont Plaza Hotel. Let's take some more calls. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening. I'm in support of the move, I hope I can get equally a time for all those who are opposed.
I think you're actually in the majority. Most of the callers seem to think the move is a good idea.
Okay, because I've heard people more or less express all kind of, what kind of influence this will have on corporations.
No, what kind of influence it'll have on BAI.
Right. Now,
unless you slipped and...
Well, actually...
corporations for WBAI.
No. First off, I'm a supporter, okay? Financially as well as listen to you most of the time during the day. Second off, people who more or less come out and, you know, like, express some reservations about it, you know, I have no problems with that. Anyone who is talking about, well, you know, maybe corporations will have an influence on it, as long as the people who listen continue to support financially, either by buying whatever premiums are offered, or by making the little $25 contributions whenever fundraising goes on, then BAI
caller,
would be able...
Caller, how do you define community radio, and what will be community's input?
Okay, let me show you one effect that I believe BAI had. I received a call from Nike about maybe 8 weeks ago. They didn't identify themselves, but the majority of questions that they asked were pertaining to Nike. And it was in reference to, like, how do we buy Nike? How many of my friends buy Nike? And the whole bit. What they were actually doing was taking a survey to see how conscious the people were as to Nike's practices about its laborers.
And what you're suggesting is that because of the information you've heard about Nike on WBAI, you were able to respond to this woman who is conducting the survey?
Yeah, because actually later on in the survey, because she kept me on the phone for about, say, 20 minutes or so.
Right.
Just
and I don't think I can keep you on the phone for that long. I think it's a good thing that you learned one or two things about Nike's exploitative practices in Southeast Asia, but I hope what BAI represents is going to be a little bit more than having a ready answer when someone from a corporation calls you to survey their products. WBAI, you're on the air?
Yes, hi. I listened to the report to the listener yesterday, and you know, I was the caller that asked him about the to be more explicit about the problems that are going on, and he wasn't as explicit as I would have liked him to be.
Right. Did they mention by any chance this move to 120 Wall Street?
No, he didn't. He said that they're having union problems and that they're having problems as to what direction the station should take. Whether the station should become more like WNYC or NPR, or whether it should go back to the format it had in the 60s, you know, or whether it should continue with the format that it has now.
Are you suggesting that it was even an option for listeners to call in and debate what direction the station should be taking?
No, I'm sorry. Is it? Well, he didn't extend that option. He just laid out the you know, what the problems were. But I would like that. I mean, that would be very helpful because I mean, you know, I'm a member of the station, and you know, I feel that I should have some kind of a voice as to the direction of the station. You know, I think there's a lot of everything is nebulous. You know, I mean, the listeners are not being informed. You know, everything is couched in vague terms. And, well, there's just no explanation to the listeners, and I don't think that's very fair. You know,
and that's not community radio. Let's take another call. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello, I'd like to thank you and applaud your courage for discussing this with us now, as I know that there
Why?
Is a gag order on programmers. I've been a listener supporter of WBAI since 1965.
As far as I know, the move was aired publicly, and it's a matter of public information. Now, if they use Bandung's airing of this issue as a violation of that provision of the gag order, then I'm going to be counting on all those callers who are calling in to back us up. But go ahead.
Okay, well, you can count on me. I mean, the move to Wall Street, considering who's making the decisions and how it's been done, I have to be wary of it, regardless of what is said to me about the positives of it, okay? Because I've been around too long and I've listened too long, and maybe the powers that be at the Pacifica and WBAI figure, you know, us old-timers aren't the ones that they care about, and if they can keep the new listeners and subscribers in the dark about what's going on, they'll be able to get away with it.
That's right. If you're concerned, do write to management. The address is 505 8th Avenue, 19th floor, New York, 10018, and write to both the program director and the general manager of the station. They represent management around here. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I'm been a long-time listener and also a financial contributor to BAI, and I'm really shocked that about what you had just said, because this is totally news to me.
You mean the move to Wall Street?
Yeah,
this is the first time you're hearing about it.
Yeah, this is the first time I'm hearing about it. You know, I mean, I'm sorry, I haven't been listening to the
Don't apologize. No one's talking about it on air. So.
Yeah. But one of the reasons why I really oppose it is because in anything, there's any organization or body carries a certain class character, and that class character, you know, or you know, class, race, sex, you know, gender, you know, character will really define what that organization will be. And I think any attempt to really try to muddle with those issues is really a move to, as some of the people have said, you know, to try to corporatize and stuff. And nobody is immune. No organization in any progressive movement has ever been immune to reactionary elements, you know, for the sake of, you know, convenience, for the sake of a lot of things, you know, and the excuse is always there. But the move is always a move to try to, you know, is always in a reactionary mode, you know, and it's a move against community radio. You know, why not move to the Bronx? Why don't you move, you know, why don't you guys, you know, take a vacant building up in the Bronx, you know, and broadcast out of Mott Haven? I'd love to see that.
Thank you. I think that's a very good question. Wall Street is not the only place with buildings available, and as Robert Fitch mentioned, if we're going to have any politics and principles to stand by, we can't compromise them just because we're getting cheaper rent. And it's also quite questionable whether the rent is going to be cheaper. Sure, $5 reduction in the standard per square footage, but we're also going to have much more space, and money is going to be needed to cover the expense and maintenance of that space. So perhaps in the end, we'll not end up saving any money at all, but just be saddled with $200,000-$300,000 debt that you, the listeners, will have to pay off, and I know you how much you enjoy those fundraisers. Let's take one more, two last calls. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi, I would really like to have had your interviewee comment on this. You know, Valerie Van Eisler spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to break the union previously. And what does that have to do with what's going on now?
She hasn't broken the union. She did try to, as part of the Pacifica board in California, to divide the union, which represents both paid and non-paid staff. We're going to have to wrap up. Unfortunately, we're coming to the end of the program. And as far as I know, as far as the union issue is concerned, management is in the process of appealing a ruling that the National Labor Board Review, I think, came out with earlier in this year, which said that Pacifica was actually trying to fragment the collective bargaining unit by dismissing the non-paid staff from the union. One last call, I think. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, it's a shame that Pacifica is anti-union, especially on a station like WBAI. I'm talking about hypocrisy. It's just unbelievable how Pacifica could be anti-union. It's just ridiculous.
It's difficult to believe, but yet that's what we face. Radio Bandung is putting together a study group in which this will be part of our agenda, and we'll be meeting next Saturday on October the 4th from 4 o'clock to 7 p.m. at the New York Marxist School. If you'd like to come to those meetings, give us a call at 212-279-0707, extension 132. We're taking down a list of interested members. And for those who have already expressed interest and also helped with some of the postage fees, sit tight. I've already prematurely retired two Xerox machines and probably going to retire a third. You will be getting the information soon, and you should be able to get the packet at the meeting next Saturday, October the 4th, from 4 to 7 o'clock for the first meeting of the Radio Bandung Study Reading Working Group. If you have any comments or questions, write to us at 505 8th Avenue, 19th floor, New York, New York, 10018. If you're interested in getting an air check copy of this program, and most particularly the interview with Robert Fitch, write to us with that interest to this address. Radio Bandung will not charge copyright violation fees if you do want a copy of it. And let's see, I think I've said all I need to say. Stay tuned for next week's program, where we hope to have, hopefully live, but if not pre-recorded, Noam Chomsky on these very issues on the state of the media in the age of globalization. Stay tuned next for Arab Voices Crescent Rising.